From JetBooks, this is Irish Business Builders, a show about great Irish businesses and the people who built them. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
You know, I'm very much a woman's woman. I really believe in supporting other women, you know, generally through my career and in life. And when I started going through the menopause myself, I was just shocked at how little support is there.
I'm Connor Carney, and that's the voice of Helen Normoyle, co-founder of My Menopause Centre. My Menopause Centre is an online clinic with a mission to empower women to take control of their menopause and thrive. Helen previously held coveted positions as Director of Marketing for the BBC, CMO at DFS, and most recently, Chief Marketing Officer at Boots. In this conversation, we talk about Helen's journey from uncertain student in UL to C-suite executive. We also talk about what it was like leaving behind a successful corporate career and steady salary to start an online business, and why they are giving away most of the intellectual property of My Menopause Centre free of charge. Helen started off by telling me where the initial idea for My Menopause Centre came about.
There were a few different things that drove the creation of the business with my fellow founder, Dr. Claire Spencer. The first thing I would say, it's very personal for both of us. Claire is a brilliant GP and now a menopause specialist, and she's a good friend of mine. We've been friends for about 8 years. We met at the school gate when I lived in Harrogate in North Yorkshire. Our sons went to school together. A few years ago, I found myself going through the menopause and really struggled with the symptoms because, you know, and I'll come back to this in a moment, but basically had not a clue. So I spoke to Claire about, you know, what I was going through, went to her for advice. Now, she wasn't my GP or my doctor. I went to her as a friend because, you know, she's a lovely, kind, empathetic person and really knows her stuff. And she helped me enormously. And, you know, I left her house that day. We were sitting down on her couch and she gave me all this great advice. And I left thinking, it shouldn't be this hard for women to find easy to understand information about the menopause. And then I suppose I started on my own journey of one, finding the right treatment, but two, understanding the menopause. You know, what I found was that, to state the bleeding obvious, every woman is going to go through the menopause. Every woman. It's a fact of life. It's the other end of your fertility. If you start with your periods, you know, when you're 11, 12 or 13, your fertility, you know, finishes as you go through your 40s and 50s as you enter the menopause. And a huge amount of progress has been made over the last decade or so around awareness of periods, chatting to girls. Dads will chat to girls. I'm sure my father wouldn't mind me saying he would run a mile if I'd started a conversation with him about my period, you know, and I was 13. he'd agree. And he might still run a mile. The reality is that for the menopause, you know, and it's changing, but it's not changing enough. There aren't enough conversations about it, and it's really, really important. So to give a little bit of context, at the moment, there are about 15.5 million women in the UK who are going through the menopause. That's almost half the women in the UK. And I don't know why the numbers would be any different for Ireland, you know, given the similarity in demographics in both countries. We're just doing some research. We'll have results in a few weeks' time. But, you know, what I would expect is that a lot of people will think that the menopause doesn't affect them. Well, the bottom line is, if you have a mother, sister, girlfriend, grandmother, aunt, they are affected by the menopause, but they probably just don't speak about it. So it impacts every woman. And then the other thing is, about 8 in 10 women are going to experience symptoms of the menopause. So that's a huge number. You know, if you're one of the lucky 20% that sail through it, that is absolutely fantastic. But unfortunately, it's not like that for most women. So as I went through my own personal journey and learning about the menopause and treatment, I came upon more and more facts like that. Facts like, a half of women say that going through the menopause has a negative impact on their home life. Half say it has a negative impact on their sex life. 4 in 10 say it has a negative impact in their career. So, and I'm a very evidence-based person. You know, I started my career in market research. For all the evidence, it's the individual stories that get you most, just about what it means to have your home life impacted, what it means to have your sex life impacted, what it means to feel like you don't have a career anymore ahead of you, that you can't work. There are women who give up work because they can't cope with the symptoms. So I suppose it's my long-winded way of saying, In answer to your question, why did we start My Menopause Center? As you can get, it's a personal passion. You know, I really believe in the need to support, you know, I'm very much a woman's woman. I really believe in supporting other women, you know, generally through my career and in life. And when I started going through the menopause myself, I was just shocked at how little support is there. I had a really tough time with my symptoms. And I figure if Claire and I can, if we help just one woman, it'll be one woman that we'll have helped. And so we got together. We've been talking about doing this for, I don't know, I think it was 2017. We went hiking together in the Three Peaks. And I say that very expansively. Claire hiked the Three Peaks. I did one. She's much fitter than me. But in the day after a good night, we chatted about this and went back and forth. And there were always issues of timing. You know, I was working at Boots. I loved my job at Boots. But the timing around COVID landed a few things for both of us. One, very practically, was that the healthcare market was going digital. And one of the things on our mind was always, where would we locate our clinic? You know, I live in Nottingham, Claire lives just between Harrogate and Leeds. But suddenly, you know, with COVID, healthcare has gone digital. So we saw this opportunity to create an online business where we could have a website packed with, you know, really great evidence-based information and advice about the menopause, which women everywhere could access. But also we could set up a clinic that women anywhere in the country could access. So you didn't have to live near a big city or a town where there would be a menopause specialist, because, you know, menopause specialists can be a little bit like hen's teeth. They can be very hard to find. They're waiting list. So we thought, massive tick in the box. It gives us the ability to move at speed, to be agile, you know, at a very practical level, to be less capital intensive than getting a building, paying a lease, making those multi-year commitments. It enabled us to personalize. Now, one of my big things for my own career has always been about, how do you deliver the best possible customer experience? Well, clearly, you can deliver the best possible customer experience the better you know your customer. And it's like, in some ways, I liken it to going full circle again. You know, when I was growing up in Adair in County Limerick, the local haberdasher, Vokes store, you know, you'd walk in and it was in the day and there was a counter, you'd hand over your list and Mr. Vokes and Henry said they got everything, Harry and Henry, they got everything for you, and would put it in a box, and Vokes is a great shop and it's still there. And Henry's probably a third cousin of mine, I think, or a fourth. But if you think about it then, we went through a period of where, you know, it went through mass distribution, mass retail, and we lost that personal touch. But the advent of data and technology and automation gives the ability to do personalization at scale. And that was a big focus of mine at Boots, particularly with the Advantage part. So in looking at our venture, we wanted to set up something where we could really give a personalized experience. So personalized in a mass way, as well as truly personalized when somebody comes in to have a clinic appointment with us. So as we thought about our business and how we wanted to set it up, we went through the customer journey. We started really by looking to understand what is it that women most need when they're going through the menopause. And there are generally four or five questions. And we've designed the website to do that. So the first question is, what the bleeding hell is the menopause? So we've got a really good section on the menopause explained. Claire's written everything. There's no, you know, dodgy stuff in there. It's everything is evidence-based, scientific. And I provide the non-scientific filters. So I figure if I can understand it, practically anyone can. So we've met to make sure it's really accessible and easy to understand with illustrations to explain things in the right way. The second question then is, if I understand what the menopause is, what are the symptoms and do I have them? So we've met a symptom checker. And Connor, there are 38 and counting symptoms of the menopause. And part of the challenge is for many women, they'll start to experience them, but not realize that they have them. And so that's a really important part of awareness raising. The next thing we did was we developed a menopause questionnaire, because a question that many women have is, am I actually menopausal or not? And the menopause is very, very tricky to diagnose, and it's really different for every woman. Dissected the decision-making process that goes on in Claire's head, created an algorithm to mirror that, devised a questionnaire that takes about 4 minutes to complete. And at the end of that, you get a personalized assessment. So that took a huge amount of time and resource to develop that. But we believe that that will be invaluable, because we're very much a purpose and passion led business, but we want to be profitable and commercially successful as well. So from a purpose and a passion point of view, our desire is to help every woman. So the information on our website and the questionnaire is available to every woman, you know, women all over Ireland as well, women anywhere in the world. And we're already seeing, getting quite a lot of hits on the website from Ireland and from the States and Australia and all around Europe as well. The clinic then, we've created an online clinic where Claire and other menopause specialists support women. It's a digital journey end to end, just a few clicks, you can book an appointment. The commercial side of this is then you obviously pay £260 for an appointment. So we recognize that on the one hand, that's a really good value investment in your own healthcare. And on the other hand, though, for a lot of women, it'll be beyond their reach. Hence, we've provided so much information for free on the website, because we figure if you can't afford the appointment, then at least you can take your personalized assessment and take it into your GP and use that to have a conversation with the GP to help, because a lot of GPs still don't really understand the menopause themselves, and in particular they don't understand HRT, which is one of the most proven ways and safe ways to treat the symptoms of the menopause. But there's a lot of misinformation out there, and a lot of misinformation that's been driven through the media as well over the last few years in particular. So if I think about it then, that they're the key things that we're doing on the website. In addition then, because the symptoms of the menopause require other types of support, we've partnered with specialists in sexual relationship counseling, on nutrition, on fitness, and on talking therapies to help with cognitive behavioral therapy and on coaching. So we really can provide a one-stop shop for women who are looking for support and for treatment. And if they want to come into us through the clinic, and we can provide a very personalized service at scale to anyone who comes to the website and through our questionnaire, and obviously one-to-one then with the appointments that we give. So hopefully that gives you a good sense of what the business is about, why we've set it up. You know, we really do want to prove the model of purpose, passion, and profit, that we can deliver all three.
So if I'm right, and correct me if I'm wrong, the model is you have a lot of comprehensive free resources available online for any woman to go on and find information, take that to their GP if they want. And then the way your business will make money or become profitable will be through the online clinic as such.
Exactly. So it's basically, you know, from a customer journey perspective, if I put that hat on, it's about converting people who come onto the site. But obviously, if you're looking for any kind of a specialist in the medical field, you want to know that they're good at what they do and that you can trust them. And so the website is also, it's like our calling card. It's the evidence of, you know, the quality of the doctors we have, the quality of the advice. We're completely independent, I suppose, and impartial. That's the other thing I should call out. We don't take any advertising money. We don't take any money, because some people have said to me, oh, I'm sure getting money from pharmaceutical companies is a big part of your business model. It's not. We don't advertise anything. We don't advertise supplements. We're not trying to sell you anything. And that's really important to us, so that we will always, you know, I say we, the doctors in our clinic, will always focus on what's right for the patient and giving and supporting them. We believe in choice and empowering and a woman's right to choose. And so what that means is that in the clinic, the doctors will provide you with the evidence-based information advice so you can decide what's right for you.
Tell me a little bit about your own journey so far. I know, so just before starting this particular business, you were CMO of Boots. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
How did you start your career, and how long, I suppose, did it take you to get to that point? And then how did you decide ultimately to start your own business from there?
So I studied at the University of Limerick, and this was back in the 80s and early 90s, so a long time ago. One of the things I love about UL is the way you do work placements, a really great thing to integrate into a degree program. And one of my work placements was with GfK in Nuremberg in Germany, because I had German as a minor. And GfK is a really big market research agency. So I was very fortunate in that they offered me a job upon graduation. So I kind of fell into market research. I was doing, you know, my business degree, I was doing a business degree, major in marketing, minor in German. But, you know, it was a great opportunity. I loved living in Nuremberg. I loved Germany. So I went and I started there. And my career kind of evolved from there. I've never been a person who's had, you know, a 10 or a 15 year career plan, because I figure you never know where life's going to take you. And I've learned the value of keeping an open mind and entertaining a conversation, and then kind of drawing my conclusions if something's right for me or not. So I was in Germany with GfK for probably about 5 years. From there, I went to Motorola. This was you will laugh, Connor, because you probably don't remember a life without mobile phones, but this is back in 95, and mobile phones are about 3% penetration in the market, and they're about £500-600 each. They cost a fortune to run. I remember in my first few years, because I traveled internationally, my average monthly bill was £2,000. Now, I wasn't paying it. My company was, thank God. So went to work for Motorola in Basingstoke, or London, as it's known to the Americans, because it's about 50 miles outside London, which, you know, American cities expand very generously. I loved working at Motorola because it combines the things that I really, really enjoy, which is, you know, understanding customers. And that was, you know, starting my career in market research was a brilliant grounding, because it really gets you focused on the customer and the questions you need to ask your customer. And that's been my passion. Everything I've done in my career, and I've got a bit of a mongrel or career, I think. But the red thread that runs through it is understanding the customer and starting with the customer and not all the shiny new toys. It was a brilliant time. Mobile phones were, you know, really just taking off. GSM was just entering the market. And Motorola at that time had about 60% market share, dominated paging. I mean, if anybody under 35 is listening to this, go, what the heck is a pager? You know, but pagers were massive, particularly in China at the time. So I was joining this really successful company, but the team in Europe knew that trouble was on the horizon with GSM, because Motorola didn't have, you know, enough products in its roadmap there. It was a very US-centric company. All of the development teams were based in Chicago, and they were incredibly successful, you know, but I learned, you know, some great lessons about arrogance and pride and a belief in one's own invincibility. Because if you look fast forward, you know, 20 years, so you see where Motorola is now. But I stayed at Motorola for 8 years and I loved it. Progressed through from market research into product development. I was asked to lead the global consumer insights team out of Chicago after 3 years. So I moved to Chicago, then led global front-end product development. So that was all the new product development stuff. Got to work with a load of hard software engineers, supply chain. Absolutely loved it. Traveled nonstop. I clocked up about 2 million miles in about 3 years, because I had teams all over the world. And again, ticked another box for me. I grew up just wanting to travel. So I loved it. It was brilliant, but it takes its toll when you're traveling like that. And then 9/11 happened and it was awful. You know, I'd been in New York the week before that at a global team meeting. Our PR team was still in the States when it happened. And I'll never forget, because I came out of a meeting, you know, back in those days, and I'm sure this still happens in American corporates, we had a 7 to 8 a.m. meeting. So I came in that meeting, one of the guys, you know the way some things are burnt in your brain. My father always says, you can remember where he was when Kennedy died. And I always think, I'll never forget where I was, you know, when 9/11 happened. It was in a meeting room in Motorola's mobile headquarters in Libertyville outside Chicago. And a guy looked at his phone. He said his wife's just texted him to say, a plane has crashed into one of the Twin Towers in New York. And I'm even getting goosebumps now thinking about it. I thought, well, that's weird. It must be one of those little twin engines, a terrible tragedy, but, you know, move on to the next meeting. And then I was driving to Schaumburg, another suburb outside of Chicago, and the news came through and more planes and more. It was awful. People were pulling over on the freeway, crying. Chicago was locked down. You know, people were evacuated from the city. I remember coming back into the office then, and nobody worked. Everybody was just speechless looking at the screens. And it was like, that was around the time of the Bruce Willis Die Hard movies. It was like we were watching a Die Hard movie. It was just unfathomable what happened. And then phone lines were down for several days. And what it meant was that my family couldn't get hold of me. They didn't know where in the world I was. I couldn't get hold of my family for the first time ever. And then getting on and off a plane was like getting on and off a bus to me. But it made me realize the Atlantic's a really big ocean. And if you can't fly and you haven't got a phone, you're really far away from your family and cut off. My sister was pregnant, my nephew at the time. And I thought, you know what? I just want to come home now. I want to come home to Europe. You know, careers are about a mix of professional and personal, aren't they? So I moved back to London with Motorola and then did a European job. And after a year, I was approached by a headhunter, a very nice Irish lady, for a role with Ofcom, the new regulator that was being set up. And I was like, absolutely no way. I don't want to work for the civil service. I'll be bored out of my way. I do not mean that in a negative way. For anyone who's listening who works for the civil service, I have the utmost respect. So please don't take it the wrong way. But in fairness, coming from a marketing background, if somebody spoke to you about regulation, and I am not dismissive of regulation. And anyway, before I insult any more people, I went to work for Ofcom and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a new regulator with a new approach. It was the era of light touch regulation. We've obviously massively moved on from light touch regulation, but it was, you know, 2003, New Labour in the UK and all of that. And it was very exciting to do something really different in that way. And part of my thinking in taking this role was to get experience in broadcasting, because Ofcom regulated telecoms and broadcasting, because I thought I would just love to work for the BBC. I love the brand. But I didn't have, you know, I didn't understand the market. You know, I'd always worked internationally, didn't understand the UK. So I hope this would give me the experience to maybe someday go to work for the BBC. So after about 3 or 4 years at Ofcom, I was approached by a headhunter for a role at the BBC. And this is my dream job. I really have to get it to head up audience insights. You know, the BBC, I thought, was, and I still do think it is an amazing institution and organization. And so, again, I was very fortunate. I was offered the role of head of audiences at the BBC. And then from there, I went on to head up marketing at the BBC, and it was a privilege to work for the BBC. You know, the stewardship of 21 brands, a brilliant team, several hundred, really understanding content. You're a real part of British society when you work for the BBC. Had a brilliant time there, learned a huge amount, loved leading the team there. And I'm still in touch with, you know, lots of my old colleagues and my old team from there as well. And then from there, I thought, you know, I'm eight, nine years now in the public sector. I'd like to go back to the private sector again. And I figured if I didn't after 10 years, I was never going to move out of the public sector, because it'd be quite hard to make the transition out into an organization that's got a real, you know, commercial imperative. So a friend put me in touch with the CEO of DFS, Ian Philby, as it was at the time. So they're looking for a CMO. You know, would you consider it? And I thought, well, timing isn't right at the moment. But, you know, in the spirit of keeping an open mind, met with Ian for dinner. We got on like a house on fire. He's a really great guy, but it wasn't the right time. We stayed in touch and then came back to have the conversation again. And again, it's one of those things. I never, ever thought that I would be interested in, you know, working for a sofa retailer. Wasn't a market. They were based in Yorkshire, Yorkshire and Doncaster. I had to Google it. I had to look it up to see where Doncaster was exactly. So, but I spent a weekend doing sofa mystery shopping and realized I absolutely loved it. It was really great fun because I do love interiors. So I thought this could be fun. So I met with Ian, met with the private equity company, Advent, that had bought DFS, and really liked what they were up to. And I suppose one of the things that's really always been important to me in my career is that I like and respect the people who are in the organization and what they're up to. And I believe in them and I believe in their values and the purpose. And I really liked what they wanted to do with DFS, which was, you know, expand the range, expand the appeal, expand into Ireland, as we've subsequently done, and other markets. And so I left London, much to the shock of all of my friends in London, we didn't move to Doncaster, we moved to Harrogate, which is a beautiful part of North Yorkshire. And again, I worked in retail and it was a baptism of fire. So for any of the listeners who work in retail, if you can imagine, I started my first day and looked at some tables on performance and went, what does LFL stand for? Now, LFL is the most important acronym in retail. It's your like-for-like sales. I went, oh my God, I didn't realize just how little I knew about retail. But I was brought in to help on the brand side and the customer side. So Ian was brilliant and incredibly supportive. And, you know, he was the ex-trading director of Boots, you know, for many years. And what he didn't know about retail, you could write on the back of a fag pack. So he really, really helped me kind of find my feet in that role. But I suppose, you know, when I give career advice to people, I always say, don't be afraid to go out of your comfort zone and to try something new, you know, because you confine your life to a really small box if you're not prepared to take a risk and take a chance. Now, take a calculated risk. And I took a calculated risk, but it was a big one. We were moving the family, you know, going to a completely new sector. But I'm really glad I did, because it was, you know, at times very, very challenging, you know, because I had so much to learn. The team were on quite a journey with this as well. But it was brilliant. We IPO'd DFS. That was a brilliant learning experience on that front as well. We grew share, increased the number of stores, expanded into Ireland. Got to work with my very good friend, Neva Carl, who runs a PR company. You know, it was a really great experience. And from there, then I went to work with a lovely lady called Alison Platt, who ran Countrywide. And it was really interesting timing because this was back in, you know, early 2016. And the view then was this Brexit referendum was an annoyance, but, you know, people would vote against it and life would move on. Oh, my God. The second thing I'll never forget, where were you the morning you got the Brexit referendum result? I nearly felt sick, Connor. It was awful. I just felt awful. I just, you know, me and most of my friends are Remainers. I have a few Leaver friends as well. And we managed to have very courteous conversations about our differences in opinion, which I think is really important. But that was personally a big shock. But obviously for a business like Countrywide, a really big shock as well for the property market. And when I didn't move from Harrogate for that role, and again, this is getting more into the personal, but the plan was that I would be in London 2-3 days a week, work from home 2-3 days a week. And with Brexit and everything, I just needed to be in London 5 days a week. And I had two small boys at the time. And it was just, you know, the toll on family life. And, you know, I love my kids and my family, and they are the most important thing to me. So I thought, this isn't right for our family life. We need to do something different. And I was approached by Elizabeth Fagan, who was running Boots at the time. Elizabeth and I knew each other from marketing circles. And she, you know, we spoke about me joining Boots as CMO. Now, Boots is, for me, is another brand, you know, like the BBC. It's a big British institution. And I loved it, you know, because I've been shopping in Boots since my oldest son was born. And it was genuinely a really regular Boots shopper. So I, you know, thought this was a brilliant opportunity. It involved a move again for the family to move to Nottingham. But it was been absolutely fantastic. I love Boots, you know, still love Boots, still shop at Boots. And it was great experience because what I got from it from a personal perspective was to meet some truly wonderful people who are absolutely customer and patient first. I'm always humbled by the people who work at Boots and how fantastic they are. And they really demonstrated in the last year with COVID. You know, our pharmacists, healthcare assistants have been absolutely incredible. And I still say our, I'll tell you how much affinity I still have for the brand and the people there. But it was also great learning about loyalty. I'd never run a loyalty card before, and really helped me to understand about what more, you know, a company can do and how important personalization is. You know, the loyalty card is a brilliant driver of incremental revenue, incremental reach for Boots and stickiness. And it's a great exchange because, you know, in return for great points, you know, we get great information from customers. There's huge trust there. Boots doesn't sell the data, do anything, you know. So, and I know, you know, the revenue from loyalty card customers is so much higher than non-card customers. But the reason it's higher is because people find the products they want because we give them the information in the right way and at the right time. And I suppose, setting up my menopause center, I've taken the learnings from all of my roles, all of my different roles, and brought them to bear to really help Claire and I ensure that whatever we do, you know, customer patient will come first. We're designing a brilliant experience. We want to get people's feedback. I mean, already we're getting some lovely emails in from women thanking us for what we're doing and giving us great feedback, and we're acting on it. You know, now that we're running the business and we're tiny, you know, teeny weeny, I've learned how to use WordPress, which is what we use for our website. So the great thing is being small versus being big. So I've basically gone from having teams of hundreds of people to me, our agency, some brilliant freelancers that I'm working with. So if I get feedback that this, you know, could be better on the website, I just hop on now and change it. It's like, as opposed to taking 2 weeks, six conversations, you know, an approval process, it's like, yeah, that makes sense. Let's do it. And that is, it's a roller coaster, but it's quite exciting when you can see yourself making the changes that quickly and get the feedback on the day.
And just thinking back over your corporate career, especially, you've had a lot of promotions and you've gone up in the world. It sounds like when hearing the story, it sounds like it was a very linear straight line up and to the right. Is that how it felt? Or did you ever have kind of doubts or anything as you were going through your corporate career?
Oh, probably most days, Connor. You know, definitely if it sounds linear, then it wasn't. I mean, it really, really wasn't. So, you know, I spent 8 years at Motorola, and a lot of what I did at that time, I would move sideways to do something. You know, a sideways move can be a great thing to do if you're learning something new and getting extra skills. Look, very few people will go through life without experiencing any bumps, challenges, or, you know, and I've had, you know, on more than one occasion in my career, run to the ladies' loo, close the door and just cried, a little cry, put myself together and come out again. Life will always have its ups and downs. I think that the trick, and when I found it, and when the going gets hard, what I thought is, I can choose this might sound a bit airy fairy, but we all have a choice about how we choose to respond to something. So I can choose to be a victim and feel sorry for myself, bitch and moan about a situation or whatever, but it's not going to do me any good. It's not going to do the people around me any good. I can equally choose to play, to get back up again and to get stuck in again and give it another go. And I think I have had victim moments, and sometimes you need it, and you need a bit of a rant to get it off your chest, you know, better out than in, as they say. But I think it's managing it to keep it small, tight, and then move on. And then, you know, having friends, you know, my best friends from school are still my best friends. I have really great friends. I have a lovely husband. My family are fantastic. So I think having the right support network and recognizing in life, I suppose what I've learned over my career is make choices that are right for your life, not just about your career. I would say for a lot of my life, my career has defined me. I think as I've got older, I've learned that that's not always the healthiest way to live. And actually, life is more fun and more fulfilling when your career is part of a context of what you do. And I suppose particularly becoming a mother started me kind of on that, you know, being with my husband, becoming a mom. Because I am, left to my own devices, I am a total workaholic, you know, because I only do things that I enjoy and that I love. And then I, you know, throw myself in, you know, ask my husband, forget about time, don't hear anyone or hear anything. So, but, you know, kids grow up quickly and they mean everything to me, as does my husband. So, and my family in Ireland, and, you know, the last year has been really tough. I haven't been home since December 2019, and I can't wait to go home this summer. So, you know, making decisions for life, not just a career. Careers are never linear. You know, I really don't believe anyone, and I see a linear career. You always think there may be some exceptional people who do, but most people go through life. And you know what? The things, I suppose, that I've learned most about myself are through those tough times. And then that's where phrases like the darkest hours before the dawn, as trite as they might sound, they really do help. And I think back to all of the learnings that I've had from a project that hasn't gone well, you know, really shitty presentation. But the thing to do with it is stop and think, what have I learned from it? And then, you know, be nice to yourself, be kind to yourself, and then learn to move on.
Throughout kind of, I suppose, the start of your career and as you went along, going to the BBC and then to Boots and so forth, did you have career goals? Did you have some idea about where you wanted to get to during that time?
I knew I always wanted to travel. So I always wanted to live abroad and I always wanted to travel. So I was clear, whatever job I did, it needed to tick that box. I knew I wanted to work with people who I liked, respected, and would be fun. So fun is really important to me. I need to have a laugh. I like to work with people who like to have a laugh and you know, take the work seriously, but don't take yourself too seriously. And also keep perspective because, you know, in my first job at GFK in Germany, one of my colleagues was from the former East Germany, because I at an amazing time, I lived through Germany through reunification. I mean, I remember the wall coming down in 89. But Andreas Penck, a really lovely guy, a doctor, qualified, I think he was from Leipzig. And we were working really late one night on a report and I was getting slightly stressed over it. And he leaned back and he said, look, Helen, you know, when I was an internist in my hospitals, I'd be doing rounds and I'd be making decisions about people's lives. He said, at the end of the day, what's the worst that will happen? No one is going to die. And that struck with me. And I thought, at the end of the day, you have a rubbish presentation, things don't go as well as you want. No one is going to die because of this. And, you know, the world will move on and you learn and you pick yourself up and the team will pick ourselves up and we learn and we'll move on from it. The main thing is that we learn. So I think that bit is really important in terms of working with people who have that perspective is really, really important as well. Also then just doing interesting work, things that I have a passion for. I could never work on something that I personally didn't believe in. So there are certain industries or categories I could never bring myself to work in because I don't believe in them or what they do. I respect other people's choices about what they do, but they wouldn't be for me. And they've been my guiding posts, you know, interesting people, interesting purpose, interesting goals, good fun, and people with a similar work ethic. I've, you know, as I said, I work hard. I like to work with people who are willing to lean in and, you know, put the time in and believe in delivering, you know, a great quality outcome.
Do you think that approach has helped you in your career rather than having an approach of, you know, in 5 years' time, I want to be managing a team of 200 people or something more maybe external or maybe something a little bit more superficial? Do you think that having your type of goals about where you want to work and the environment you want to work in and what you want your life to be, do you think that has been a help to you?
It definitely has. I mean, I think from, when you're in an organization, you know things around the teams that you want to run or the places. So those things are definitely a consideration, Connor, but they wouldn't be the primary one because, you know, as I've coached people through my career, people are working for me, they'll say they'll want a particular job. Sometimes people will say they want a job title, and then you get into a really interesting conversation around what's motivating you. Is it the job or the job title? And then is it really what you want and is it right for you? Because I've never been one to go for a job title because it's meaningless and I don't know if it'll make me happy or feel fulfilled. So, but I know there are people who do, but it's always an interesting conversation to play back to them to understand their motivation. Is it about the status? You know, we all have egos and status is important to people, you know, when they think about it. And I would be lying if I said that wasn't important to me. And that was actually one of the, if I'm really honest, one of the hard things about leaving a big corporate world to become a startup is, you know, I knew I was leaving behind my lovely CMO title. And it did take me a while to get my head around there, to get used to, you know, to that idea. But it came back to me questioning myself around, what's my motivation? What's the impact that I want to have? And what do I want to do? And how important is that job title and that corporate role kind of in that scheme of things? And you go, well, it's not enough. It's not enough. But sometimes it's hard to be honest with yourself. I find sometimes, you know, you know what it is, but you kind of go, I really wish you didn't think that, Helen, you know?
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
Did you ever think about starting your own business, or is it something that kind of happened all of a sudden, or did you think you would eventually go there at some stage?
No, to be honest, I didn't. And this is why I surprised myself. You know, if you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have said, you know, you want to be running a company, da 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 da. It would have been kind of in that space. But running my own business, I don't think would have been on there. But it's because of my passion for this particular topic. I can't imagine running another business, if you know what I mean. It's because of, you know, my personal experience of the menopause and also seeing that there's a real gap in provision in the market. It's kind of both coming together and kind of thinking, you know, I've got some good skills that I can bring to bear here. I know some good people. And then finding Claire was key to this because I think we're a great team. We work really well together and we complement each other. She is the medical expert in the relationship and all of that. And I can help with the support and the go-to-market and in getting the information out there and making it accessible. But it's also, I think about, I found the right person to set the business up with, and I really enjoy working with her.
What has been the biggest challenge between starting the business? Has it been the fact that you have far less resources now than you would have had in one of the larger companies? Has it been kind of where to start without the support? I mean, what has been the biggest challenge so far?
All of the above, Connor. You nailed it. So the first thing is, you know, when you go from a team of several hundred, you go, can the team doing XYZ do XYZ, please? And they do it and they're well resourced and they have all the kit and stuff. And then you kind of go, there's the mirror, that's me. So I need to do all this stuff. But I knew that going in. I knew. And it was, to be honest, part of the appeal for me as well, because I love learning new stuff. So I figured I was going to learn a load in doing this. And we want to really build a business from the ground up. So both Claire and I, and I've roped in my husband as well, who actually uses Xero. He's an accountant. So we have very complementary skills. And we really are building the business ourselves from the ground up. And we found some brilliant agencies, but definitely resource. And there not being enough hours in the day. So what it means is that I've had to prioritize like never before. Because I've said I'm really conscious of my workaholic tendencies. And I want to be a great mom to my kids and, you know, daughter and wife and everything. So I can't work unlimited hours in the way that I would have before. So I've just got to ruthlessly prioritize and focus on the things that will make the biggest difference. And there's no luxury. There's no luxury of nice to have little things. So, and I knew that would be the case, but it's been more the case than I thought it would be, I think, in bringing that out. And obviously being a small, you know, business and a startup and we're self-funding, you're much more conscious of, you know, cash flow and investment and what are we getting out of it? And, you know, do we spend our money in this or in this? My budgets are tiny compared to budgets I would have worked with before. But again, I knew that would be the case. So that surprised me less. It was more the, I suppose, the need to really ruthlessly prioritize. And then, you know, a couple of people had said to me, when you go to work for yourself, the highs will be higher than anything you've had before, but the lows will be lower. And that is definitely true. It really is a roller coaster. I think if there's anybody out there who set up their own business, you're putting a little bit of yourself out there into the world. And you have to be, it's quite a vulnerable place to be because you're not behind a brand. I mean, I've always given 100% to anything that I've done, but it's been for brands or for other things. Whereas this is 100%, but it's me and Claire, you know, it's our views, our thinking. And so you're kind of going, I really hope people like it. I really hope they'll find it useful. You know, it's a bit like, you know, when you have your children and their babies and you want everyone to tell you your baby's lovely. And generally people do, at least to your face. You know, I'm joking, obviously. But, you know, but when it's your business and you get feedback and people say what they think on social media. So you've got to be resilient to the thick skin and be humble. So I keep reminding myself, all of this feedback really is great and it's going to help us make a better product and deliver a better service to our customers. But at the same time, that can be quite tough, knowing you've put yourself out there that much.
In a way, you might be taking kind of constructive feedback more personally than you would have if you were behind a well-known brand, for example.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's it, Connor. And it's just learning, you know, and what my belief is that people are fundamentally good and decent. So I will take that belief into the feedback that it's coming from a good place and it's there to help and support. And, you know, so far, so good. We've had lovely feedback, really positive, and some really great bills. And so bills and feedback through email and through social, which is helping us to make a better, to provide a better service and to help more women.
I'd be really interested to hear about some of the decisions you've had to make in terms of prioritization. Maybe you've had big ideas that you wouldn't be able to execute on because of resources or time, because there's only the two of you. Can you think of any examples of where you've had to compromise, shall we say?
Yeah, look, it's a really good question. Like many businesses, we've got to kind of manage supply and demand. So in our business model, the demand is clearly from people coming in, booking appointments, and the supply is the hours we have with doctors. So the hours that we have in our appointment book. We have specialists, you know, we pay them well because we want the best people to come and work at the clinic. But we've got to, the challenge is, how do we make sure that we're always a bit ahead in generating the demand over the supply of hours that we have? And particularly in the first, you know, I imagine 6 to 12 months of the business, that's one of our biggest challenges. So while people might look at it and go, it's not like making widgets or whatever, there are the same kind of demand and supply challenges as well in the industry. And so I was thinking about it yesterday. It reminds me a little bit of, you know, at DFS, we had to manage, you know, the capacity of the factory to the demand we were creating and how would you optimize for that and how would you move it around? And so that's, but I quite like that challenge. I think that's what I like about it, that thinking about, well, and what I'm really enjoying is really getting into which channels are generating the demand. You know, we've invested in HubSpot for our customer relationship management, and it provides a really good set of dashboards. So I suppose the other thing is, being a small startup, we're, you know, we're working with off the shelf providers. And so in many ways, they're a lot better than kind of what the systems that a lot of legacy companies will have, because they're having to tweak and refine them, and it would cost them an absolute fortune to shift. So it's providing us with some great analytics. And so again, because we're so small and the buck stops with us, we can optimize all these things in real time. But it's that resource balancing one. And I suspect, you know, that's probably the biggest challenges for most startups is, how much do you put into supply and demand?
It could be seen as, you know, by some people as a big risk to leave a very successful corporate career behind, a nice annual salary, I'm sure, to start your own business. How did you think about that risk and how things might turn out? You must have had some confidence in the business idea initially. Just to give people a feel for, because I know there's probably some people listening in corporate jobs that have always thought about maybe starting their own business, but that step is seen as almost too much of a risk for them.
Yeah, no, and I don't blame them. And this was not a decision that I took lightly, and it did not happen overnight. So it took me a few years to get my head in the place to do it, because I did think about, could I set up the business with Claire without leaving my day job, you know, and, you know, as more of an investor and providing guidance and so on. All of those thoughts went through my head. And I definitely looked at this really, really thoroughly from a number of angles. And they, at a very practical level, I did a really detailed business case to look at this with Claire. So to say, you know, is this part of my personal passion, you know, could I look to set up a charity, provide the website? From a commercial point of view, is this a viable business? And, you know, is it commercially self-sustaining? And we went through, you know, we did a lot of research to look at the numbers, to look at capacity. And I suppose, as I mentioned, Connor, if we'd had to go straight into being in a building, a lease and all of that, I do think it would have been more challenging. But the fact that we were able to go digital, it just meant that, you know, there's a big investment we make in the website, the algorithm and all that side, but we don't have the recurring running costs with leases and all that. We've a very flexible model, and we've built our business to scale, but starting small, but we've put the foundation. So we've really thought about scalability. We've really thought about the business case. So that's kind of the reason to believe, you know, and that's the anchor for the future, is it? So, and I thought, yeah, okay, so there's that. Then there was the bit around, you know, not having that paycheck come in every month, and how was I going to feel about that? Because, you know, it's going to take a while for the business to turn a profit, and we'll be investing for quite a while. So how am I going to feel about that? So we did the practical thing of looking at our finances to make sure it was affordable and I wasn't going to get stressed out over stuff, because it's hard to be your best when you're stressed, you know, over money, you know, and anything else. And then the ego thing was definitely, you know, I really feel embarrassed mentioning it, but I think it's important to put it out there, because I'm sure a lot of other people will be thinking about it and might not want to admit it. And all I would say is, it's very natural and very human to kind of worry about who are you without your job title and who are you without your job. Yeah, because it, you know, go to a party, go to a party, oh, where do you work? What do you do? Blah, blah, blah. And there is a certain amount of kudos that comes with being, you know, a director of something or other or a CMO. You get invited to lots of nice things, you get to speak at things. And I thought, oh, what if I never get to invite to anything again? What if I never go anywhere? What if I fall off the radar, you know, and all of that stuff. So I did really have to think about all of that. I suppose I thought, one of the things I always think about is when I'm on my deathbed, I don't want to have any regrets. And I want to look back in my life and think, you know, I've done what I've done will have made the world a little bit better, and my kids will be proud of me. And I thought, when I'm on my deathbed, would I be happy to kind of go, I had this opportunity, I really thought about it, but I didn't do it. And I thought, no, I'd be really pissed off at myself, you know, and it might all go belly up. I've no idea. But I figure, you know what? I've got to give it a go. I've got to give it my best shot. I've got to give it my best shot.
Has there been anyone you've looked to for advice, or even any resources that have helped you with these decisions?
Yeah, definitely. I've been very fortunate to work with some great people throughout my career. I really believe in asking for help. And most people in life, when you ask them for help, I've actually never encountered anyone who said no. And I know it's the same with me. Anyone who comes and asks me for help, I'm more than happy to help and support people, because I think I've been very fortunate and very privileged with things I've been able to do in life, and I'd like to pass it on. And the people that I've worked with and who have helped me like that, they've been like that too. And I've learned a lot from them, you know. So it's the little things and the big things. So, you know, what I've learned from some of the people I've worked with is the importance of saying thank you to everyone at every level. Just a little email, a quick text, a quick word, a phone call, the difference that can make. I've learned the importance of being humble, you know, when you feel yourself, and, you know, I can be stubborn and I feel myself digging my heels in. It's like, pull back, get perspective. Great advice in terms of thinking of your career as a marathon, not a sprint, you know, and having that perspective. I've always had a coach because I think no matter how much I learn in life, there's always, you know, a good coach is worth, and it's the investment. You know, I've had it paid for professionally when I've been at work. I pay for it personally now as well, because I think I believe, you know, in the whole concept of continuous improvement and ongoing learning. And my philosophy in my own life is I will learn till the day I die. I intend to work in some form or other till the day I die. Please God, you know, my health, and I'll invest in my health to enable me to do it, because I love learning and I love life. Having a coach along the way can really help you to learn more about yourself, to challenge yourself and to challenge your thinking.
Can you think of an example of something that you might have discussed with a coach previously and how you've implemented that in your business or in your career to date?
Yeah, I think I've had so loads of coaching conversations over my career. And I suppose some of the key themes would definitely be around leading for the team and how to get the best out of people and how to get the best out of myself, and then understanding myself and what motivates me, and different tools and techniques that you can use to bring people together as a team. So, you know, whether that's Myers-Briggs, whether that's colors, you know, there's a whole host of them out there. They're all really good. They all do different things. But at the end of the day, what they teach you is to understand where people are coming from, what motivates them, because that's kind of a foundation to getting the best out of people. The importance of having an ambition or shared vision that you have as a team, so that you all feel united and doing for something, and then building trust so that when you hit a sticky patch, as every team will, people won't assume the worst about somebody's motivation. They'll stop and think, well, that's not like so-and-so. They must be having a bad day, so I'll check in to see if they're okay, as opposed to going, I can't believe, do you know what they just did? You know, that over the course of my career has definitely been an important part of all of the coaching conversations that I've had on a one-to-one, but also on a team basis.
Can you think about anything that you have discovered about yourself that might have come as a surprise to you?
I didn't realize how driven I was. That's not always a good thing, Connor, because I'm very passionate about what I do, and I'm a big say-do person. So if I commit somebody to doing something, come hell or high water, I'll do it, because my word is my bond kind of stuff. I have very high standards of myself and of my teams. But I hadn't realized the positive of that is the drive and what you get forward for it. But, you know, I suppose one of the great insights and learnings that I've had is the shadow side of things. The shadow side of that can be too much pressure and too demanding on the people that I work with. I hadn't quite clocked just how that could be, because I thought, but we're all in this. We all said we would do it. So I think as I got older and more experienced, I think that's definitely been a shift in how I lead and in how I see things. So I would have before said it's important to work hard, you know, have fun, do the right thing. I think I've evolved my mantra now to kind of say it's about definitely about doing the right thing. I think that's really important. I would say it's about working smart, not hard. So being really think about what will make a difference. And while you can say everything can make a difference, some things will make more of a difference than others. Then I think a key learning for me is about being kind. You can give tough feedback, but you can do it in a kind way. It's not about not making tough decisions or whatever, but I've really learned through the highs and lows of my life the importance of kindness and compassion to oneself and to people around one in life. I think this world sorely needs, you know, just more kindness and more compassion and more empathy and more understanding, because the world is very polarized at the moment. I'm hoping that with what we're doing at my menopause center, it will help with that kindness and compassion. But I think as a leader, and I think very often that's seen as a woman's thing, you know, it's a bit soft. I think you can be demanding and results orientated, but you can do it with kindness.
Can you give me an idea of what the business looks like today? How many people are you, and what the plans are for the near future and in subsequent years?
Yep. So at the moment, there's myself, Claire, and two other doctors. My husband, we've got an agency, a brilliant digital agency, born and raised based in Sheffield, doing our website. And then we've got two freelancers and a PR agency and a research agency. So basically, it's a network where the model is keep our fixed costs really lean and then bring in the right people to do the work that we need doing, but find really good people to come in and support us. We've built off a digital platform that can scale. Desire is to build out with our menopause questionnaire and with our website to help as many women as possible. So we're looking at building awareness, investing in all the things you'd expect us to around Google and Facebook for that. Word of mouth would be key though. And then for the clinic, really looking at optimizing our conversion funnel and customer relationship management to drive the appointment book. So, you know, in a few years' time, I would love for us to be publishing the results of our menopause questionnaire, because we need more information on the menopause in the market. I would love for us to be able to say we've helped millions of women, you know, understand their menopause better, go get better treatment from their GP, and that we have treated, you know, thousands of women in our clinic and helped them to live. So they're not just surviving through their menopause, but they're really thriving through it.
Where can people find out more about My Menopause Centre or about you if you'd like them to get in touch?
Go to www.mymenopausecentre.com, all one word. I'm on LinkedIn. My Menopause Centre is LinkedIn. We're in all the social channels that you'd expect us to be as well. Or send an email to hello@mymenopausecentre.com.
Helen, thank you very much for a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you, Connor. It was a pleasure.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Our team of qualified accountants leverage the power of cloud technology to automate your manual processes and cut the cost of your finance function in half. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. I'm your host, Connor Carney. Thanks for listening.